Hello, good evening, and you're very welcome along to Midlands 103's Life and Times as the second of a two-parter, quite obviously. My guest is back in front of me again today. I have to say, David Norris, we got a very good reaction to last week's programme.
Oh, thank you very much. So this is son of David Norris.
This is... Right. Last week we were talking about up to when you started lecturing in
yes.
Trinity. What age were you at that stage?
Oh, I was very young. I went in and I think I was probably 21 or 22.
Lecturing?
Yeah. I was lecturing to people who were older and hairier than I was.
How did you...
You know, I had all these big, fit, young men and beautiful English dolly birds with names like Gloria Bolingbroke Kent. Terribly intimidating. I was this little squirt from Dublin lecturing all these people. But I kind of fell in love with them and they fell in love with me because I never used a script. And some of my colleagues used to read out these yellowing old things. It might have been brilliant academically 20 years previously. But I took the risk, the high wire act. I had a couple of idiot cards. That's the thing from the cathedral last Sunday, because I go to St. Patrick's every Sunday. But that size on stiff cardboard, and I would write out a couple of points on it. That was it.
Where did you get this wonderful communication skill that you have? Because you can make things memorable in your style of presentation. Now, I've been to many courses and I've been to many lectures and I've been to many sales training things, and the guys have had good things to say, and I'm always selfish about this because I want to learn. But when you talk, you remember it. You have this wonderful connectivity. How did that come about, do you think?
Well, I'm not really particularly aware of it, but it might be genetic, because I don't remember my grandfather. I spent my first year in Ireland in Leash, in his house, but I have no recollection of him, and I'm sorry for that, because I think he must have been marvellous. My aunt said that the local people adored him because he had a way of telling a story, because he had no nonsense, no airs about him. And he came from one of the old and great Gaelic Irish families. But they were sadly reduced. First of all, they held on to the Roman Catholic faith for quite a long time. And so, of course, a lot of stuff...
They didn't take the King's shilling.
They did eventually.
Right.
But when it was too late, it was no bloody good. But he inherited four encumbered farms, and his father died when he was one. And so there wasn't an awful lot of money. He had to try and build up the farms again. He had to do this and that. He did a bit of auctioneering. He ran the post office. He was Divil McCare.
Did that for money?
Well, do anything to keep engaged in life.
Not, I say that in the flippant way.
He was the worst person with money, my poor aunt. You see, I'm lucky enough to be able to trace my family back for a very long time. And it's great fun. Anybody can do it if they're lucky enough to pull one thread and it unravels the entire jumper. And you discover, in my belief, everybody has the same amount of princes, paupers, prostitutes. They're all a mix. But my
poor old grand... By the popularity of these Who Do You Think You Are programmes.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I was asked to do one of those, but I came up with so much old rubbish that I kind of killed them with an overload of information, you see. But
did you do any courses in terms of how to project yourself? Or is this just your...
No, but my grandfather did.
Okay.
My brother, he didn't do courses, but he had it naturally.
Mm.
And then, of course, Bram Stoker fell in love with the theatre. And he was a wonderful orator himself. I mean, he's the only person who was both the auditor of the Historical Society in Trinity and the president of the Philosophical Society. These are two societies who are at each other's throats, and he managed to achieve the highest office in both. Do you know what my record with them was?
No.
I joined both in my first term, and I was expelled from both of them in the first term. I was expelled from the HIST for academic nudity, which is not at all as exciting as it sounds. It means I didn't wear a gown to one of their meetings.
Right.
And for the film, I refused to pay a fine, which I considered to be unfair. It breached my notions of justice, and I refused to pay it. And I got gold medals and honorary memberships and all the rest of it from those societies. They seem to conveniently overlook the fact that I've been kicked out.
But David, I don't like using the word controversial.
Yes,
right, because it's just controversial. It's a nasty word. But I think.
Well, I don't mind it as long as you're controversial in the right way.
Not just
to upset people, but because there's a principle at stake, and you know that you can do some good. I mean, Mary Robinson was controversial. And people caught up with her. My greatest political ally and friend, whom I adored, and you may have heard of him, but you know, it's amazing. As you get older, people seem to disappear almost without trace, but I don't think Noel Brown will ever go
Noel
without
Brown,
trace completely.
Yes.
Noel Brown was intensely controversial all his life, but look at the good he did. I mean, eradicating tuberculosis in this country, which was a scourge. And then introducing the mother and child scheme, which was to look after nursing mothers, to make sure that every new family with a newborn infant in the country, both the mother and the infant, were properly nurtured and properly looked after.
And these are all things that we take for granted now.
But he broke through with them.
When was your first fight? In terms of a principled argument or something that you felt there was an injustice or you felt was wrong?
Well, the first one was in school, where there was an attempt to discipline me on the words of a woman who wasn't in her right mind. I mean, she accused me. She was well known as being a bit daft. She used to cycle around an upstairs model around Moorhampton Road and Clyde Road and so on. And she accused me, she came in and identified me and accused me of knocking her off her bicycle. And I actually had an alibi. You know, I wasn't even outside the school at the stage. And an attempt was made to punish me. I just simply broke the cane and threw it back. Because I would have taken my punishment.
If you were guilty.
If it was, yes, but I was certainly not. And I'll tell you the other one, even earlier one. I remember when I was 3 years old, the black winter, just like what we've been through now, of 1947, when everybody was snowed up. And I remember the lovely, crisp, deep, virgin snow that I could see out through the French windows into the back garden from the dining room. And then the little neighbour's brats were let in to ruin my snow, into which I had not been let because I was a little tropical African violet that had to be pampered and kept inside. So not only was I not allowed to play with my own snow, the other little blighters could get at it and kick it around, make snowmen and everything. I never felt so outraged. And of course, I tell you, one of the people in my life that I loved and I still love and I feel her around me, my grandmother who died when I was 11. And she had the most erect carriage, and she had a kind of an umbrella with a Malacca, with a tassel on it, and she used to wear a toque and a choker. You know, the kind of black ribboned with pearls on it, and this. Oh, she was a real Victorian, but she had the most tremendous sense of morality and justice. And I think she kind of inculcated.
Have you ever felt that you're a man in the wrong time? That maybe, would you have been better in Victorian?
I think there are terrible disadvantages and wonderful advantages to every age. And I don't want to be in any other age than this. I do want to make a contribution because I think we've made a terrible mess of it. And the people in the next generation
are going to have to pick it
up. They're going to really face a lot of difficulties.
Mind you, I read an article recently when you were asked what age was the best age to be at. And you had said that
18.
18.
Yeah.
And you've been 18 for 40-odd years.
I have, nearly 50. Nearly 50, because I'm 66, clickety-click. And do you know something wonderful, Alan?
That was a wonderful answer.
I have got my free travel. I grabbed with both hands. I'm entitled to a small contributory pension, which I have not taken, because I think there are enough people who need it a lot more than I do. And I thought, particularly when I saw that they were putting prescription charges on and naming in the statutory instrument the terminally ill and the homeless, I thought, I cannot take money from these people. But I grabbed the free travel with both hands.
Do you use it?
Oh, I do.
Do you?
Of course I do. Because things like the Lewis. You see, it's wonderful. I can whiz out to see friends. I can whiz up to the theatre in Dundrum. So I use both lines. But I'm not terribly good at machines. And it often happens I'd be foosting around trying to extract the ticket from the machine and the tram would come along.
And go.
So now all I've got to do is wave me past and say I'm an old lad. It's great.
Can we go back then in terms of lecturing at Trinity? What was the next significant thing do you think that happened to you in your life at that stage?
Well, I mean, the next significant thing that happened was I suppose, the aftermath of the swinging 60s, when all kinds of new ideas about human individuality and human sexuality and everything else came out. And there was the formation. The student welfare officer from Trinity went to a conference in the north of Ireland about sexuality, students and sexuality, and came back. And they started something called the Sexual Liberation Movement. And it was like the Women's Liberation Movement and the Black Liberation Movement and all this kind of stuff.
Basically, stuff Mary Robinson would have been very much involved in that, was she?
Well, she wasn't at that stage, actually. No, she wasn't for some reason. I mean, she was... I don't know why. Well, I think she was politicking, but separate to this. And I don't know whether she'd arrived at that point yet. But in any case... it led to the development of the Trinity branch, which is called the SLM. There was the Union for Sexual Freedom in Ireland, and then led to the SLM, Sexual Liberation Movement. And from that, I got involved, and I started was involved with a number of other people in starting the first gay movement. That was a critical point, because up till then I hadn't been political. I had a sense of justice and injustice. And I could see that this was unjust and it did huge damage to people who could be sent to jail.
They criminalised it, hadn't they?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
In Britain, and it spread to here. You know, it wasn't an Irish thing at all.
Our judicial system is still very much based on this. Yeah.
And, I mean, people, including people I knew, were subjected to forced electric convulsant therapy, ECT. People were forced
to cure them.
Yes. And aversion therapy. They'd be shown erotic films, and if they became aroused, they were all measured. I won't spoil the evening by telling you how they were measured.
I'm sorry, you're reminding me of... I just finished rereading...
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, is it?
No. Indecent Exposure by Tom Sharp. And Tom Sharp was a lecturer in South Africa back in the 60s. And he was a bit radical and he was chucked out. But he wrote quite a number of books and they're amazing. But the first one was Ancestral Vices. And it told the story of this little old sleepy town in South Africa, which, you know, had these old, grand old English buildings on. But it was a bygone day. But it just took the piss mercy out of the apartheid system and all that. And then he followed it up with another book called Indecent Exposure. Yeah. And Indecent Exposure, this guy who was the commandant went off and this guy was going to run it, but he was going out with this, you know, psychiatrist, and she came up with this aversion therapy that would round up all these black ladies and photograph them and then show them to the white constables, and if they got an erection, they'd electrocute them, and that was the aversion therapy.
It.
This is satire,
but this actually happened in Ireland in my lifetime. But Tom Sharp is a wonderful writer, and my favourite of his is Porterhouse Blue.
David Jason.
The language is so exquisite. And, you know, I mean, he's very much... You know, I put that book on the course. I gave a year-long course in comic fiction. And I put Tom Sharp's Porterhouse Blue on. And one thing, he said... prolonged attention to the inessentials of an argument can frequently derail it. brilliant insight.
I got to send you Indecent Exposure.
Please do.
Most certainly will. We need to take a commercial break. We'll come back in 2 minutes' time. We're in conversation with David Norris. Please stay with us. You're very welcome back. It's Life and Times with David Norris. David, before the break, before I derailed myself there, you were becoming very much politically aware at this stage.
Yes, but only in quite a narrow sense, because this was an injustice as I'd suffered
myself. It was kind of a single issue.
Yes, it was. But it was so exciting and so wonderful because we banded together. We started a little group. And then we decided we should, you know, celebrate. And we had a little bit of a hop, like an old tennis hop, with a gramophone in number 4 in Trinity. We thought about 20 people would come. 240 people came. And I said, well, we can make money out of this. So we started running discos.
Okay.
We eventually ended up running the hottest disco in Ireland. In Temple Bar, the thing that launched Temple Bar, it's all forgotten now. Do you know who came to it? Anybody who's interested in that kind of soul music, Viola Wills came to it, Elton John came to it, Freddie Mercury came to it.
Came to it?
Absolutely.
Wow.
And they meant nothing to me. Wow. I didn't know who they were.
Oh, I think just Freddie Mercury, amazing. Yeah.
And Elton John, who I was on the door. And I wasn't sure if I should let him in until I saw all these flunkies coming behind him with bottles of champagne and freshly squeezed orange juice. And I thought, he must be somebody important to let him in.
Yeah, you left him in anyway.
Yeah, but that thing, we had a cinema, a library, a restaurant, counselling services. We were involved in fighting back AIDS. And I authorised the printing of 250,000 leaflets about safe sex. And that was a criminal offence at that stage, you know that? Under the Indecent Advertisement Act, if you gave information about venereal disease or VD clinics or sexual health, you could go to jail. I sent this to a copy of the leaflets to the Minister for Health, Barry Desmond, and saying, "Dear Minister, I'm publishing these because I think it's the interest of health of the young people in this country. I realise it's a prosecutable offence. Can I have your comment?" He wrote back, "Dear David, thank God somebody's doing it. It's about time."
Fair play.
Well, that is the positive side of the Irish solution to the Irish question.
Did it take long to get things changed?
Well, it took a fair amount of time. I mean, I was working on the law case from 1974 on, and it didn't change the law. The law didn't actually change until 1993, so that's nearly 20 years.
Wow.
But I learned a lot in that period, and the most important thing I learned is that all oppression is the same. Injustice is the same in its general outline. Just as, you know, that wonderful man who works in the mathematics department down in Cork says there are only four jokes in the universe. And everything else is a variant of them. And he's worked out the mathematical formula. It's the same with injustice. Because the kind of injustice that afflicts gay people also operated against women, against disabled, against racial minorities, religious minorities. It is the same mechanism presented in a different guise.
Yeah.
And if you have imagination and human sympathy, a moment comes when you move outside your own narrow grounds and you start feeling the injustice of other people and the mistreatment in the way my wonderful friend Tom Hyland did for the people of East Timor, whom we'd never seen. He just knew this is wrong. It's got to be stopped. And that's a principle that has always affected me. And I think, and this was the argument I always made to people who got stuck in the plumbing, I mean, human sexuality is deep, sexual activity is deeply unattractive to anybody except those participating in it, unless it is a very well made pornographic film. And I'm not sure there are any of those, but there may be. There are beautiful people, obviously, I mean, because it is a ridiculous situation to be in, unless you're fully engaged in it. As I was saying, I always made the argument to people who got stuck in the plumbing and got obsessed by the mechanics of sexuality. You may not find this kind of thing attractive. You may find it repulsive, whatever it is. But it's not actually doing harm to people. And civil rights and human rights only really exist, and your expression of them is only really tested when you feel obliged and able to extend them to people with whom you don't agree, who don't represent your point of view. I mean, it's terribly easy to say, oh, yes, it's dreadful what they're doing to those Coptic Christians, for example, because we're Christian here. We have a sympathy. But, you know, it's also equally important to know that it is dreadful what's being done to the Palestinians. You know, so the principle is that when you establish what is a human right, you know, the right not to be tortured, the right to food, to an education, to the creation of a family life, that extends to people you might not like at all.
But I seem to remember one stage reading an article where it suggested that Ireland was only basically democratic, that as far as, you know, in the pure principles of democracy, that Ireland would not feature very highly at all.
Well, I think like every other place, we're very patchy. I mean, we have given so much to the world. We've given so much to the liberty. We've Daniel O'Connell. I mean, look at Daniel O'Connell. What a wonderful figure. Unfortunately, he's been eclipsed by the tradition of violence because that actually won out at the end of the day.
Mm.
But a man who was the apostle of human liberty, who spoke out in the 1820s, not just against the penal laws, which my own family has struggled against, and I'm very, very, very proud to say all three sections of my family, the Roman, not just the Roman Catholic, in whose interest it was, but also the Anglican, in whose interest it was not to speak out. It was to be greedily holding on to what they had, and the Quaker section of my family. Daniel O'Connell spoke out for Jewish people who were discriminated against. He spoke out against the discrimination against black people and against slavery. And actually, you know, I made a film about a man from not too far from here in 1983, the late John Count McCormack.
Mm.
And the film was called, inevitably, I hear you calling me, for RTE. And I knew very little about him except the background noise of his wonderful records. But what a voice. Oh,
but he was the superstar of his time. I mean,
he was, but do you know what I loved? When I fell in love with him was when I discovered that when Oscar Hammerstein died, Oscar Hammerstein the First, he asked the Roman Catholic Archbishop of New York for permission to attend his funeral. And because he was Jewish, it was denied. And McCormack was very devout Roman Catholic, and he wrestled with his conscience and went to the funeral. And even better, in Chicago in 1911, he was a musician, a writer, a composer was visiting him. And when McCormack saw him out of his penthouse in this hotel, he showed him to the lift, and the man said in a very embarrassed way, I'm sorry, I can't use that lift. And McCormack said, why not? Oh, he said, I'm black. And McCormack said, look, you are my guest, and if my guests are not good enough for this hotel is not good enough for me. And he went down and he confronted the manager. 1911. I think that is absolutely fantastic.
The past number of decades, David, you would have had really a window in Irish society, because you're not just involved in looking at it, you're involved in the machinations of it and so forth. How would you describe the progression of Irish society in the last, I suppose, particularly in the last, we've become now a multicultural society in the past 10 years, and we have the opportunity of not buggering it up like the French and the British did. But, you know, in the lead up to that, how have we changed, do you think?
I think we've changed a number of ways. First of all, the infrastructure is remarkable.
Mm.
I mean, all these roads, which make it so easy to drive up and down here twice, to get over to Galway, to be able to fly to Galway on Air Éireann, and long may that continue. I think the advance in communications, I mean, it was impossible to hold us back. I mean, the censorship acts were in full swing when I was young. You can't censor anymore. It's impossible.
But I remember even, going to see movies like The Life of Brian.
Yes. Life of Brian was banned.
Yes.
But the other side of it is this. We had a huge boom with the Celtic Tiger. And some aspects of that were a bit vulgar. And I think we perhaps didn't quite always retain the really lovely things about Ireland.
We seem to have lost hospitality. We lost a lot of our identity, I think, in the last few years as well.
Well, perhaps up to a point, but I think we can get it back now. The danger, I think, and you see, the awful, awful thing was that virtually nothing was left for young people to believe in, for them to have ideals about. If you look at it,
everything that we believed in. Banks,
the corruption of state,
yes.
The banks,
yes.
The church, the law, all the four great pillars of society called into question. Young people who are full of idealism, so little left to believe in.
And becoming cynical at such a young age, yes.
So, and I think there's the danger that we may be making a jump from unthinking Catholicism to unthinking materialism. And I think that would be terrible. And I think this kind of scandals in the church have an awful lot to do with that. And I think that would be to our terrible, terrible loss.
Well, what I'd like to do now is we're coming to the last part of the programme, and I'd like to get a little political, if I may.
Oh, please,
I need
yes.
to take a short commercial break before we do that. It's Life and Times, Midlands 1 and 3. David Norris, please stay with us. You're very welcome back. It's the final part of Life and Times of David Norris. And to be quite honest, Really, where I wanted to go, we haven't been able to get there. But the one place I do want to go, and I want to get your views on the Senate. I want to get your views on the presidential election. I want to get your views on the current political situation. Yeah. You can take those in any order that you want. I suppose, first and foremost, the current government is really a lame duck government of epic proportions. We have an election coming up in the not too distant future. Part of that, there's the suggestion of having a referendum to do away with the Senate.
Yes.
What's your view on that?
I have no problem with the referendum. I think they should either reform it or scrap it. I mean, it is disgraceful that it's allowed to continue in this way. And I can tell you, in this session of Parliament, I tabled the results of the All-Party Commission on Reform of the Senate, and the Senate voted against it. Their own report. Now, the university seats work. Why? Because the nominating body is the students. 10 graduates can nominate. But then the graduates' body, 65,000 of them, have the right to vote. And it's the same in NUI. They have over 110,000 voters. The others, the last election that was held was a by-election. The total register of voters was 227.
From who? County councils or...?
Members of the Oireachtas.
Oh, OK. Sorry.
Members of the Oireachtas and county councils can usually vote, but this is a by-election, so it's just the Oireachtas members. Now, I just think that is completely wrong. What they should do is they should democratise it by reviewing all the nominating bodies.
Is there a function for the Senate?
I think so.
What does it do?
Well, it revises legislation, it introduces legislation, it pioneers things, and it has in so many ways. Without the Senate, you wouldn't have had Noel Brown. You wouldn't have had Fergal Quinn in it. You wouldn't have had Joe O'Toole. You wouldn't have had Mary Robinson. I mean, there's a list that could go on and on. And I could list for you the achievements of the Senate, even in the last session. Joe O'Toole and myself, he proposed, I seconded, amendments to the NAMA legislation, with the Dáil had failed to get in, which gave for the first time Oireachtas accountability. 2 weeks later, I proposed and he seconded amendments to the biofuels bill, highly technical stuff that I was up all night reading so that I'd understand it. Succeeded in forcing those amendments in. That has started the process that will give 1,000 jobs in the Waterford area. That's worth doing. Neither of those were noticed anywhere. And I could go on and on and on, but it'd be self-serving. But I am self-serving. So I want to skip over that. Leave that argument to the people.
Okay.
And come to another argument that I would like to see left also to the people. And that is the presidency. Because you're absolutely right. I do want it. And I am.
What could you bring what could you bring to the presidency?
Well, what I could bring to the presidency is a completely positive attitude, a creative imagination, and what I've learned from teachers like Brenda Kennelly, the capacity to inspire people, to release that wonderful creative energy that people have, and to fan that spark of intuition into a blaze. Now, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I was at the Young Scientist Exhibition. I mean, my goodness, if anybody wanted a lift, that was the place to be, out in the RDS in Paul's Bridge. And I said to several of the young people there, you really should look at getting a patent. Do you know what they said? They said, we applied yesterday, or we applied last week. I mean, the brilliance of some of the ideas, like that electronic helmet that gave indicators so that you don't have to take your hands off the bicycle. Wonderful safety thing, will save lives. Even better, in my opinion, the defibrillator. What a difficult word to say. The defibrillator. You know, all these situations where young athletes drop
dead on.
Sudden
death syndrome.
Sudden death syndrome. This is a thing that has an application for a mobile phone or a BlackBerry that can turn it into an instant defibrillator.
And would be able to shoot that kind of power.
Yes. And can actually get out there on the field. It would spread them so far. I think, one of my favourites there, I didn't get to see them. So if there's anybody listening from Clonakilty, please forgive me. These are the people who inspired me. A group of transition year young women in Clonakilty. There's a problem. Seaweed. The rich nutrients flowing off the farmland has created a bloom of sea lettuce.
Yes.
Wadges up on the shore. Hmm. Sun strikes, it stinks. Puts off the tourists, nauseates locals. They went out, took samples, chemically tested them, they discovered that they can turn them into briquettes, which have the same heat equivalent as turf and burn twice as long. I mean, isn't that wonderful?
Isn't that fantastic?
They take a problem, they isolate it, they identify it, they qualify it, they examine it scientifically and objectively, and they turn a problem into something positive. And there were so many, I don't know how many, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of projects there were there. These are the people who are going to lift this country. And we have so much in the way of natural resources. Look at what is out in the Atlantic shelf. I mean, the capacities for the growth of food, the development of fish industry, the development of various kinds of vegetable life on the seafloor. And I won't get into too controversial an area, but people will know my views on the Corrib field. And the estimated flow that I've read in various articles of 500 billion euros.
Giving it away.
Our natural resources.
Giving it away.
And what I would love to see back is the Keating regulations that were reversed by the government after the Labour coalition left. Justin Keating, who amplified the constitution and said in those regulations that a sufficient proportion of the benefit from our natural resources that belong to the Irish people should accrue to the Irish people.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's just, again, this is my love of justice. Now, of course, I can't mix it politically.
Do we have a corrupt political system?
We have an inadequate political system.
Good answer.
I mean, I'm loath to use the word corrupt, although to my great sadness, I've seen cases of corruption. They've been exposed in public. And I'm just as hurt
Is our electoral system antiquated, outdated, and doesn't work? I think we're only one of two countries that have the electoral system that we have in place. We have parish pump politics. We have people who are hopelessly inadequate. It's like the Peter principle in management. They end up in areas of responsibility where they have absolutely no concept of what they're doing. However, we've elected them and they get appointed there.
Mm. No, I don't think it's necessarily the system of election, although that should be looked at. Don't forget the Irish people like PR. Dev tried to get rid of it. He got into the park in the same election. And they had a referendum on it, and it was resoundingly defeated. On the one hand, they put Dev in resoundingly, and on the other, his policy they scrapped.
Right.
So they know what they're doing to a certain extent. I don't like to second-guess the Irish people, but certainly it should be looked at. And the calibre of candidates and how you get people in, and there are young, idealistic people, and let's not allow them to be disillusioned. And, of course, reform the Senate if you're going to keep it. I can tell you,
What reforms would you like to see in
the
Senate? I would
look at every single one of the nominating bodies and I'd ruthlessly go through them and I would expand them and remove some so that the nominating bodies covered every aspect of Irish life so that everybody's interested, whether it was people who work at home, lawyers, farmers, agricultural labourers, lawyers, doctors, nurses, teachers, all these, all involved. Most of them are at the moment. But the difference is they're not allowed to vote. They're not allowed to vote. It's only the members of the Oireachtas and some of the county councils that can vote. I think that's wrong. I think it should be extended so that the Irish people have the say. And that's why I'm worming my way around back to the presidency again, because I would like the opportunity to present myself to the Irish people. And that is all I ask, that the Irish people should be allowed to make that choice. At the moment, it's in the hands or the political parties.
You started campaigning, David.
I started campaigning, but only in a kind of responsive way, because it started about 6 or 8 months ago when a Sunday newspaper phoned me and asked me, was I interested in going for the park? And I said, well, why do you ask? And they said, well, because there's about 1,000 people on a website that have sprung up spontaneously. And I said, well, I didn't know that, but I'm very flattered. And, you know, I'll certainly take it into account. And you can take it from me that I'm the kind of person, if a ball lands at my feet, I don't stand there with my mouth open saying, oh, look, a ball has landed at my feet. I'll give it a bloody good kick, see if I can score a goal. And it led on from there. And there's now something like 33,000 on the combined websites. I have a very good, very professional team in place. I have my ideas ready. I would very much like to do the job. I believe I could do a good job. And I believe the fact that I was one of the founders of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and I've met people, including cabinet ministers, heads of state, and met them on the basis of being an intellectual equal. And I also have a certain articulacy, a certain fluency with language. I'm not likely to be caught out. And
You have wonderful self-belief.
Well, I suppose some people would say that was untrammeled ego.
Or confidence.
Well, I think you have to. And I think that's what this country should have, because we have so much to have confidence in. I've just been writing the foreword to a book about Irish people from each one of the 32 countries, written by Mr. Moran. He's a developer. He lives. He's been a builder, an entertainment person, all this kind of stuff, living in England. But he's taken every county and shown how we've contributed to science, the arts, literature, diplomacy. It is fantastic what this small nation has done. So, yes, we have a lot to be confident in, but because of the foolish, criminally foolish handling of the economy and the giving of the bank guarantees, all this stuff that I voted and argued and spoke against, we have lost our confidence. And I do believe that I could help as president to give that confidence back.
Are we reduced in our image abroad?
Momentarily, yes.
We've
become lampooned. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I wouldn't want to personalise this, but things like the Jay Leno show. And I mean, it is so easy for cruel people to take somebody else's weakness and make it a laughing stock and don't care how much damage that does either to that individual, their family or their country. Then I think that is a great shame. So I think we have to assert. And of course, there are always the gloating voices who like to see it. We got a bit above ourselves.
Love to see the Irish crowd dragged back down a little bit.
Yes, they do. David, and that happened to me in Shannadarran, where I made certain political accusations against the then Cathaoirleach. And I'd been, I suppose, a bit of a pest and full of myself, and because I was right about quite a lot of things. And they saw the opportunity to do me in. And they instituted an investigation and they threw me out of the Senate. And I said, look, I'll cooperate with your inquiry on the following basis, that I have, can be legally represented, I can introduce evidence, and I can cross-examine witnesses. And like Maggie Thatcher, they said, no, never.
Yes.
And I said, fine, I'm out of here like a light, I'm into a taxi, I'm collecting Mary Robinson, we're going to the High Court. And I won. And it turned out I was right in everything I'd said, and I had to be readmitted to the Senate.
David, time has beaten us. I have 9 pages of notes here, which I haven't even looked at or got near. There's so many things that you have done, that you're going to do, I can see from this. You're a broadcaster. I know that you've and you're very familiar on the airwaves. What do you do to chill out? What do you do to relax? What do you do to...
I read detective novels. I go for walks. I got a house in Cyprus for the price of a second-hand car 10 years ago. And I spent 10 years restoring myself. It's way off the beaten track. And it is just peace. It reminds me of the Slieve Blue Mountains in the 1950s.
So and you told me that you've actually got your final resting place in Laois booked.
I certainly have, in Roskelton Parish Church in the graveyard there. It's a little 18th century church. And my great-great-great-grandfather and his son and his grandson are there. My grandfather is in Mountrath, but I'm related to virtually every single person in the grave, including a lovely woman, the late Phyllis Telford. They had a big hardware and
yes, Telfords, yes. William Telford. And
yes, do you know them?
I do, yes.
Although
yes.
I think they're great people. And she will be a kind of cousin, I mean, second or third cousin through marriage. Her husband would have been. And she died recently. She's buried there, and I'll be next door to her. And I went down last year to find they'd put a little concrete pillow with the name David Norris on it. And it was wonderful. And I lay down on it, and I thought, this is going
fits.
To be really nice.
David, please God, you won't be using it for a long, 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 long time. That's about it for our programme. Thank you so much for spending the past 2 weeks in our company. We really, and I have to say, it's been one of the most entertaining programmes I have done in a long time.
And maybe in the autumn or next year, whether I get into the park or not, we can come and have a look back and see, well, this is what happened, this is what didn't happen, and where now? It'd be rather fun, wouldn't it?
We'll have the kettle on for you here anytime.
Great.
David Norris, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Albert.